Okay, we'll call to order the June 24th, 2014 meeting of Stanislaus County Employee Retirement Association.
I agree with you.
Can we get a roll call?
Gordon Ford?
Here.
Maria DeAnda?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Jason Gordon?
Here.
Mike Lynch?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Present.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Michael O'Neill? Jeff Grover? Jason Bordeaux?
Maybe they're trying to tell me something.
Again?
I'm here again.
You don't have to come next time.
Well, does that make up for a previous one, or do I get one off?
Joan Clendenin. We have a form.
Okay. I'm going to start off with a short announcement regarding Operation Choke Point and what I think is the first settlement. Hand this out regarding it. The United States Justice Department's Operation Choke Point is intended to choke off bank services to companies deemed to pose a reputation risk, such as ammunition sales, escort services, online gambling, and payday loans. The Justice Department reached a settlement with the parent of Four Oaks Bank, accused of routing $2.4 billion in payday loans and earning $850,000 in fees. The board agreed to pay $1.2 million in penalties to avoid a legal fight. Any other announcements?
I have one. If you recall, at our last meeting, when we went into closed session, the board gave us direction, specifically Scott Smith, to continue the negotiations with Greenfield Partners. And if Scott could get to a point where he was comfortable with the language that was in the side letter, that we would go ahead and consummate the appointment of the investment with Greenfield. And so we did. Scott got comfortable. You have an email correspondence in your packets that conveyed Scott's sentiments. And as such, I'm going to have now Kelly officially announce the board's actions on this item.
On April 22nd, 2014, in closed session, action was taken on item 9A. Motion was made by Jeff Grover and seconded by Jason Gordo to allocate $15 million to Greenfield Partners and direct staff to begin legal review process with Hanson and Bridget and negotiate contracts with the approved managers. Roll call vote carried unanimously. Darren Garrett was absent during the vote. Further, after review and direction by the board at its June 11th meeting, Stan Sarah has committed $15 million to the Greenfield Partners Real Estate Investment Fund.
Okay, no public? No.
I have one announcement, yeah. Mr. Chairman. As I spoke to you earlier, I have another appointment that I need to attend. I'll be leaving at 2:30. My presence here today is to make sure that the board has established a quorum and to approve the early items on the calendar.
Thank you. No public here, so no public comment. We move to consent items. Anybody want to pull a consent item? Or can I get a motion?
I move to approve.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? So passed. Move on to item six, annual update capital prospects.
Responsibility for assets from Stan Sarah. We have passed our 5-year anniversary at this point, so in January of this year, so we thank you very much. We also thank you for accommodating our change of schedule so that we were not flying out here on Memorial Day last month and the switching with Legato behind the scenes, so thank you very much for that accommodation as well. Well, we're here for our annual review. You have the materials, I know, already. Just by way of firm update on page one of our materials, really nothing has changed organizationally or in terms of people in this past year. Our assets under management at the end of May were about $1.4 billion, which are noted below. We have 8 public fund client relationships comprised at $1.4 billion. And the nature of assignments are listed below. We focus on the long-only U.S. space, predominantly U.S. equities. And so the nature of accounts are all basically reflective of that. We have a staff member, Karen Meyer, who's noted there at the bottom of the first page, who has, she'll be coming up on her 2nd anniversary in the fall. But it's worth just noting, she's experienced in our business, but was reentering the workforce. And her role has evolved over this past couple of years. She's doing much more with us now in terms of the analytic reporting that you receive from us on a quarterly basis, some of the narrative writing on the managers and on the economic overview. She has a long history. She worked for the New York Fed and the World Bank and loves to write. So some of that writing is reflected in your quarterly reporting that you're receiving from us now. We are currently interviewing for our next senior research role. That's been an ongoing process for us. As a small firm, we're a team of 6 right now. As a small firm, it's a very big decision, and so we're taking our time. But we have 5 very viable and strong candidates that we're working through the process with right now. So hopefully by the next time we see you, we will have something in place and be able to report that to you as well. We do have 1 new client relationship, which is not yet funded, and it seems to be taking forever, so we'll see how that goes. But Siegel Rogers Casey, who is a traditional consultant in the in our business, has hired us to sub-advise a small cap portion of their collective fund family. As I say, hasn't funded yet, but we will keep you up to date on that when we see you next. Over to page 2, we are sometimes asked about our ability to properly look after plans of different sizes, and so we just listed out the of that group of clients that I mentioned on the first page. This is the size of those plans. So it really is a quite an array of sizes of plans, and we have been able to adequately service all of these relationships. We get good marks generally from our clients, and again, we're appreciative of the business you've given us. Our org charts on the next page, again, not much changes. Karen Myers down the center on the bottom, and there's a little narrative on what she's doing now. I don't think there's anything else really to mention on the staffing side. Bios are on the next page, as they typically are. And we've been through this nature of presentation with you, you know, several times, and can pick up on page 5 with some description of the research universe of the managers that we do work on, and then our process and so forth. But I would just take a minute to see if that's of most interest to the board for us to, we can review that very briefly. We can skip over to page 12, which is where really where the program review is.
Nothing has changed within our process, I guess, is the key thing. So we continue to do things the same way we have in the past.
So without any guidance otherwise, we'll just go over to the program review. Is that all right? Okay, very good. So page 12 is kind of the history lesson, which we like to remind everybody about. And I do think it's really powerful, particularly with an account such as yours, to look at the actual dollars. You know, we tend to focus so much on investment performance and relative performance, and of course that is key. But the funding date of January 2009, as I say, we've just passed our 5th anniversary, you know, was a really dark time in our markets. It was about as dark as it got. And you stuck with the strength of your conviction to execute your asset allocation as you were... looking back on it, it was a very positive thing for you to stay to the process that you've established, because that literally in March of that year was the low in the market. So you've been able to capture for the plan you know, everything that has occurred since that time. And I think it's very powerful when you look at the dollars. We were allocated $49 million. You see the series of both scheduled ongoing cash flows out, as well as a couple of more significant ones, and then we had a call, capital call on of a little over $2 million just here in April of this year, and yet we end at May of this year, the account has $94 million in it. I think that's kind of the power of what took place over that period of time, and the fact that you stuck with your guns and did the funding when other plans we are well aware of chose not to do so. We were actually, I think we have one of the our badges is that we were hired by a plan who actually never funded the program. We were hired in the summer of 2008, and they just couldn't execute. So having gotten that great letter that said, you know, we're happy to have you on board, it didn't happen. So anyhow, the list of managers is in the box here to the right with their dollar amounts allocated. As it stands at May 31st. Manager changes, you will remember we had a manager, 10 Asset Management. The portfolio manager's name was Jeff Kerrigan, and he, 10 was having organizational issues. He joined a firm called Haber Trillix. We followed with him. He delivered very successful results to your plan through our program. Sadly, not long, a few short months after he joined Haber Trillix, the founder of Haber Trillix chose to close the firm for a variety of reasons. So this great portfolio manager who we liked so well, who had done a great job, not just for you, but for several of our client accounts, had to resettle somewhere, which we're happy to report he has done. But in the meantime, we had to look after your assets. And what we chose to do was to introduce a firm called Pacific Ridge, who actually focuses on the microcap area of small cap, so the very smallest part of the small cap spectrum on the value side. And they were introduced here in November of last year. We don't have any concerns with this manager roster as it is right now. I will just mention, you may recall, InView Asset Management, there were some organizational concerns that arose here not that long ago. We've spent a lot of time with Glenn Klechka at InView, and including a full day kind of operational review in his offices. And I had an update as recently as just beginning part of this month. And he has instituted a number of procedures and operational. He's really strengthened the operational backbone of his firm. We were never concerned about it along the way, but I think it's in a much better place now than it was even at the time. So, from our point of view, we don't have any concerns with your manager roster as it stands.
Regarding InView, I don't know if you recall, but I think the last time you were here, probably close to a year ago, maybe a little less than that, one of the trustees had a question regarding InView and the percentage of their total, InView's total assets under management that belonged to StanSara. And I think I had reported out to the board a few months ago that it was around 22%. Is that pretty much the same as it is now?
That would basically be the same today. Okay. What Glenn has done, which in our mind is the right thing to do right now, as we've spent time with him on the kind of operational aspects of his business, he has just kept his nose down and he's delivering results. The results have been very good. From our mind, that's what we want him, you know, that's a positive for us to see him doing that right now. There will be a point that as he can move on to the next phase where marketing again is going to come into his life a little bit more dramatically. He's got great numbers. He's done a really good job for us, and we have him in several client accounts, but I would say that ratio is probably about the same as it was.
Thank you.
Okay, so coming over to page 13 is a profile of the program as it stands now. The structure of the program has remained pretty much the same. The managers, you know, they all have different approaches within the value, the small cap value segment of the market, and use different ways of putting their portfolios together. And our objective is to have a very balanced mix, giving us exposure across kind of the broad range of, you know, sub styles, if you will, within small cap value. So we kind of look at this as a combination of a core position with Channing and InView, and we put Pacific Ridge in there now too as dedicated micro cap value, and then around the perimeter some more eclectic approaches, if you will. As a result, we feel that the program is very well diversified. We do have kind of a quality bias. That's true of everything that we do across the firm, regardless of style. The managers tend to gravitate towards higher quality investments, which we think is fine. And as a result, you know, some of the measures look very good compared to the benchmark. We also, although we don't manage the portfolio to have this outcome, the growth rate tends to be higher than the benchmark, and the valuation levels, the PE ratios, tend to be lower. So we think that that indicates that the managers are finding good opportunities at good valuation levels. And it is managed at kind of a moderate pace of risk level. The next page, page 14, just shows each manager in terms of their sector allocation, which is more a falling out of the investment process that each one of them has. I think the interesting thing, of course, is the benchmark, the Russell 2000 value, is a challenging benchmark in that so much of it is in financials and many, many, many small banks. We have been underweighted in financials all along and continue to be that way relative to the benchmark, and overweighted in industrials and technology and consumer discretionary. Those four sectors make up about three-quarters of the benchmark and also three-quarters of the investment program. But again, the weightings are very different from the benchmark, and that's been an important characteristic of the fund. 15 is a snapshot of the largest holdings in each manager's portfolio in the total fund as of the end of March. And then moving over onto page 16 is a page on performance. We'll stick with this page, but the page following it has some commentary that looks at results since the beginning of the program. And then the pages following that take each year individually and talk about what was going on in the market and what the fund results were as a result. But just to kind of summarize, since we updated you a year ago, we finished 2013 on a good note. It was an environment that was much more conducive to stock picking for the managers. It became, as the year went on, it was less driven by all of the macro events and crises that really supported kind of the previous few years sort of risk on, risk off environment. And so the managers felt that this was more of the kind of long-term average, if you will, environment that they were used to seeing, in which stock selection would be rewarded. So we finished 2013 330 basis points ahead of the benchmark. And again, as I mentioned before, the sector allocation accounted for about 60% of that outperformance, overweighting industrials and consumer discretionary, which were really strong performing sectors, and underweighting financials and utilities, which were weaker, had a lot to do with the good results, and stock selection contributed as well. As we went into the beginning of 2014, what had been doing well last year continued to do well for some period of time. And you know, I think we all saw some crazy things happening in biotech and technology, which is less of a factor in this portfolio than on the growth side of the equation. And then everybody got concerned again about the economy and what the Fed was going to do, and they became much more defensive in their posture. So we had a little bit of everything at the beginning of the year, and some of that continued you know, into April, and May had reversed that a bit as well. And I think if you look at the dynamics of the individual managers, it kind of bears out the way the program is structured. For example, Bernzot and Channing tend to have very different patterns of performance. One of them will be performing well, the other won't. And then you see reversal, and that happened within the first quarter. So it is, as we say in the comments, we don't expect all of the managers to be outperforming all of the time. And we don't expect the program to be outperforming all of the time. But on balance, we expect each manager's strategy to win out over time, and that has been the case, as each of the managers in the program has added value since inception and every year and year to date in the program. So we think the dynamic is working well, and you know, the trends are continuing to be strong.
I will just mention, we noticed you never find these things
until airplanes.
The airplane. It's always on the airplanes. There's a couple small typographical errors.
Or in the lobby.
That leads to a panic attack, however. On the plane, you have plenty of time to get over it. We will send a revised page. It doesn't change the outcome of what Liz's comments were at all, or how the managers have done relative to their benchmarks, how the program's done, et cetera. We just noticed a couple things, so we will send you all a copy of that to just have as an updated record.
So then maybe page 15 burns up number 2 and 3, which are telecommunications systems and Broadwood's financials. If you turn to the prior page, under that particular company, you have zero in either financials or telecommunications.
They probably are actually classified in a different sector. I'm not that familiar with those particular stocks, but I don't know what Broadridge Financial does, but they do not own financials. And both of these come off of the same source, so it's classified somewhere else.
It's usually the GIC sectors that often happens that something that looks obviously to be one thing is actually caught up in industrials or something. So we can tell you, in talking about what Burnside does, that he has no exposure to financials.
Liz, do you see the relative weightings changing over the course of the next year?
Among the managers?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, we've pretty much stayed with the same mix, and the cash flows, you know, allow us to rebalance when those happen. I mean, that's what we do with them. I think we're pleased with the relative weightings.
Do you see their over underweighting relative to the benchmark changing? The individual managers.
Yeah.
Going forward.
In terms of the performance you're talking about?
Well, in terms of how they're weighted relative to their benchmark, over or under. Do you think that pattern that we see here is going to persist this year? Like you have, you're overweighted in industrials and consumer discretionary.
Oh.
Is that going to remain the same?
It really falls out of what the managers are doing, and we see slight changes here and there over time. I think the one thing that I would say wouldn't surprise me if I saw it happen, depending on what was going on in the underlying environment, was more participation in financials. If, you know, as managers feel that there are attractive opportunities there, because it is such a big portion of the benchmark, and maybe not for Burnside, but for the others. You know, because they are aware of their weighting relative in particular to that segment, and I think it's always a challenge to find interesting ideas in that segment, and to the degree that those emerge, I would expect to see that weighting change. But it really hasn't changed much over the entire course.
Gordon? Real quick, Broadridge, I'm familiar with them. They're basically it's a support service to the financial services business. So they write newsletters and articles for people in the financial services to forward on to their clients and prospective clients. So it's not they don't do anything in the financial services business other than write newsletters and articles.
Just the title is confusing.
Right. Yeah. So they're more of a content provider than a financial services company.
Like many mutual funds, remember when the mutual funds would title their funds something that was not...
The AIM Value Fund?
Right. Yeah.
That was a mid-cap growth manager?
Right, it was a mid-cap growth manager, yeah. And there's been some attempt to correct all of that, but...
Everything's legal as long as you disclose it in a prospectus.
In that smallest print
right.
possible.
The one document nobody will ever read.
Ever. But they've simplified it, right? So... Well, as Liz said, you know, the remainder of the book just you know, puts some narrative around all of those comments. We do continue to put in this year-by-year analysis because I think it's important, particularly over the period of time that your program's been in place with us, to remember what was going on in 2009, which was pretty dramatic. And so we continue to include that. And then at the very back of the book, we have one-paragraph narratives and a snapshot on each of the underlying sub-managers that are part of the team with what their, it begins on page 21, what their particular focus is, where they're located, what their assets under management are, et cetera.
And these are SMA only. There's no fund or...
No fund.
So we're very pleased with this performance. We tell you every time that we see you that the pleasant surprise is to see it change at some point. But, you know, we don't have many programs we can tell you where every single manager has added value to the benchmark since inception. That's just, you know, they do different things. We expect there to be periods of time where someone's doing better than somebody else. But in aggregate, we're very, very pleased with this performance, and we certainly appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to you about it.
Any other questions?
We're pleased also. Thank you.
We're glad.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll move item to seven. SIS.
Thank you very much. Yes, go ahead.
This is the PIMCO document, item 7A. This memo is just kind of an outline on what they're proposing to do with their cash requirements, both on a duration basis and credit quality. Right now, StanSara is a little different than their current protocol, which allows for 365 days. The cash duration, along with the credit quality of A-, we have a 360-day policy with a credit rating of A2-P2. Doesn't really change anything in the strategy. It's just a formality so that their operations can be a bit more automatic. And they've spotted it, recognized our policy is different than their operations, and have asked for approval and permission to alter that.
I'd like to add one thing that I talked to Matt Clark. This definition in terms of the grade or the quality of these cash equivalents is the average. So they've always been able to keep in their portfolio A1, P1, but now they're moving the average down. Just to let you know.
That lowering.
Right.
Lowering expectation.
In your opinion, is this a, how big a deal is this?
It's not a deal at all, in the sense that it might affect 1 to 2 trades a year as far as what's in the portfolio. You know what? Anytime the consultant says it's not a deal at all, just setting themselves up for So let's say, as the memo states, it could affect 1 to 2 trades a year as far as what's in the portfolio or not.
Why was the 360 days sent as a benchmark to begin with?
That is a very sophisticated question. I'm going to attempt to answer it in the sense that bond yields, when the calculation is done for a bond yield, it's based on a 360-day calendar. However, when you calculate an effective yield, it's done on a 365-day calendar.
Or six.
I'm sorry?
Or six, 366.
Well, I don't know what happens in that case. Yeah. But it's I don't know. You know, why it was in place, but assuming the policy on our end was written, was done more by a banker, effective bank yields, maybe that's why it was put in place. But
it's a common number?
Yeah, so.
And some.
Right, so for instance, let's say you're calculating a bank yield and the bank interest is distributed twice a year. So the way they'll calculate that is take what the interest rate is for 6 months and then just multiply it by 2. In actuality, it should be geometric. So it should be not just a simple multiply by 2, but it should be an exponential 2, and that is incrementally larger on a 365 basis. So yes, that was a very, your question is in the weeds, but hopefully that answered it to some extent.
Thank you. Need to go for a vote on this
room? Well, somebody needs to make, might I suggest a recommendation for a motion here?
Yes.
So what we would like is to change the investment policy definition of cash equivalents, and you could either do one of these, both of these, or neither of these, and that would be to increase the cash equivalent definition, increase the duration of the cash equivalents from 360 days to 1 year, and or lower the credit quality for the cash equivalents from A1 P1 to A2 P2. Correct.
I would say the first one would be a better choice for me.
Want to make a motion?
Well, it's not on the calendar for...
Yes, it is.
Is it?
Next item.
7A.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
I make a motion, the first one, to increase it to 1 year.
I second it.
Move in second. Can we get a roll call, please?
Can I have a comment?
Sure.
I mean, this is the appropriate time.
Absolutely.
For discussion. So PIMCO's, or Paul, his recommendation is that we go with PIMCO's recommendation, which is do both, right? Move it to 365 and to lower the quality credit minimum from A1 P1 to A2 P2.
Correct.
So are we saying we're going to go against our consultants?
If the motion on the floor is carried, then you're absolutely correct.
So your motion is just move it back 5 days?
Yes.
Okay.
And why would you be satisfied with just one part?
I think that the market for A1 P1 is sufficient, that we shouldn't need to go down to A2 P2. I mean, the market for A1 P1 commercial paper is just huge.
And in talking with Matt, he said if he had a choice, he would prefer the duration be changed as opposed to the credit quality, I believe. So I'm not, one way or the other, regarding the credit quality, I'm not concerned either way, whether we change it or we leave it as it is. But I think for operational efficiency, from PIMCO's perspective, then changing the duration is the right way to go, at least the duration.
How significant is the difference between A1 A2, P1, P2.
I'll defer that question to Nate.
On fire today. That's another very sophisticated question in the sense that the rating discrepancies for a company considered hundreds of variables, and so the rating agencies will effectively grade these companies periodically based on the status of the financials. There is a correlation to the market cycle and how companies' profitabilities and balance sheets look. But I'm not going to go as far as to say there's a very minor discrepancy between the two, because most danger or most potholes are outlier events that are not detectable by an agency. So on paper, there are very small differences. It's one credit quality lower, but there's always, you know, risk anytime you take more credit risk on the spectrum.
Nate, how much
what's the far end of the range? P10?
Oh, no, we would go down, it starts in the, again, depends on the agencies, but you go through different grades of A, you go different grades of B, one top grade of C, and then you're getting to high yield and things that is not being rated by the agencies, which are generally smaller companies that don't have access to the public markets.
Sorry.
That's all right.
So some rating agencies go like AAA, AA, single A, BBB, BBB.
Yeah, I understand that. I just
and then there's
seen this piece
differences right across each of those AAAs and AAs.
They also try to make it as confusing as possible so they can stay.
And they've succeeded very long.
They do. I mean, the language is foreign, some of those.
Maybe you could definitely explain what the cash equivalents are used for in PIMCO's business.
So it's effectively will be it'll back underlying positions. So if they have hedges or things in place, they need to have cash that backs those hedges. And these instruments act as cash because they're effectively so liquid. They are, in our sense, we want them to use this because they do get incremental yield on these securities, but it's effectively cash backing a position in the portfolio.
It's collateral. And how much of the portfolio at any one time do you believe has these cash equivalents out there as collateral? I would imagine it wouldn't be very large, would it?
No, it wouldn't be large for two reasons. One, you can get a lot of exposure with very little dollars. That's the benefit of being an institution. We get access to certain risk premiums with very little capital because of the credit quality and quality of this institution. So it's more of a tool and a toolkit. It's good that this discussion comes up because it's kind of very mechanical and technical to not only PIMCO, but a lot of other strategies out there. But as the memo states, the duration is the most important as far as helping the operations run a bit more automated. There are expenses because there are custom, unique aspects to our relationship, which to some extent gets passed back to us, but not enough to affect your decision.
I call for the question. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford?
No.
Maria DeAnda?
Yes.
Don Riley?
Yes.
Jason Gordo?
No.
Mike Lynch?
Yes.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Okay. Move on to C. No, to D.
So this is the memo kind of outlining where we are in the infrastructure study. What we want to take away from this is one of two things. Get direction from you to move forward with the shortlist to go to a finals presentation where we would invite the managers to come in and present. Or we move to additional education to where we can get maybe more granular in some of the exposures and ways we can access the infrastructure asset class and continue on this journey. Well, I'll wait for this until we get to the market update. So the memo has three strategies in particular, two, be it IFM and JP Morgan, which are traditional core yet open-ended strategies. And we have one MLP, Harvest, which was a welcomed recommendation from trustees. And they are different in their way that they access their investment convictions. And I'll go ahead and outline some of those at a high level. And definitely stop me and ask questions as we get into this. So infrastructure in particular has become an institutional asset class, especially in the United States over the last few years. It has forerunned abroad in the European space. Institutional investing in infrastructure has been around for quite some time. And both the managers, IFM and JP Morgan, have a bulk of their assets in European infrastructure. Being that it's simply more mature and institutional space has been developed over the last few years. Infrastructure could be anything from airports, telecommunications, roads, tolls, you name it, things that generally have a toll or a fee associated with it could be classified in that infrastructure category. The main traction is that we're getting a yield, the current yield, somewhere in that 6 to 8% range, and over time, asset appreciation that more or less will track inflation. This is going to come as a rotation. We're stepping into this out of our equity allocation, which we look at our targets is slightly over. I'm very glad we're having this discussion 2014, June versus June 2010, 2009, when a lot of institutions were knee-jerking trying to race out of equities. I mean, there's an article in the journal that actually is there today that says big investors missed the rally. Stansara, we did not miss that rally. We held to our convictions, as Marilyn said, and have that equity risk premium in place. And it has dramatically benefited the beneficiaries. We'll see our dollars when we get to the monthly performance report. So the fact we're having this conversation now, I think, is appropriate. I comment at a high level. It's really healthy. And both managers that we're bringing to you, IFM and JP Morgan, are core. What does core mean? It's getting that kind of broad exposure to the asset class. It's not necessarily looking for home runs, but being able to deliver a conservative return with a conservative risk matched to it.
What would constitute a home run?
It would be like we go out and develop an airport in eastern Ukraine. That would be a very risky proposition. But if it works, we're going to get paid huge for it. A core is we're going to buy a toll in London where people go across the bridge every single day.
We're going to buy the Bay Bridge.
Right. Okay. That was a pretty good example I gave you right there. Right off the top.
Very good.
Quite home comfort with myself.
You're on a roll.
Another aspect to...
Well, this is all risk.
I'm going to be out there in an equity-like risk.
Think earthquakes.
We're going to... A unique characteristic of kind of what we brought to you is the open-ended structure of these two funds. So they're closed end and open end. Closed end, which is very private equity-like, means that there's a lifespan to this investment, meaning that, well, it's generally speaking infrastructure quite long, maybe 10 with 2, 3, 1 year extension. So you're committing to an investment that's 13 years. And the fund, by definition, cycles out of these investments somewhere along that, the twilight of it. Open it means these are good core investments. They're not, the fund manager, the strategy, is not forced to sell trophy assets. Consequently, there's a bit more stability when investors stay in the fund. And also, the J curve, or that, which is a we're experiencing to some extent with direct lenders, is mitigated because assets are in the portfolio, they're functioning, and they're throwing off yield. Because we're stepping into this asset class, it's a new asset class, we really think it's appropriate to bring a core, very sound, proven strategies that, again, are looking to create singles and doubles versus those home runs.
When you say basically an open plan.
Yes.
And I know this has been was one of our concerns before when we started looking at infrastructure, is basically should we find ourselves in need of funds or something, mm-hmm. we can go in and pull out, you know, blank amount or the whole thing without any penalty consequences. I saw when I was reading this, there are certain times during the year, basically, when there's some cash out.
Sure. Yes. That's a really important distinction. So the first benefit of the open end is what I just said, the way the strategy, the investment conviction is laid out. The other end is what you said. There is more liquidity, but let me be clear. It's not nearly the kind of liquidity that's available in the public securities. IFM, for example, you have a quarterly opportunity to raise your hand and say, okay, we want to get out. But the manager then says they ask for 36 months to get that request completely out. The reason is they're trading and buying and selling bridges. It's a lot harder to get out of certain assets than a stock per se. So that said, a 36-month window is significantly more liquidity than would be offered if we go into a standard closed-end fund, which there is no getting out.
But they give you the 30, they say they want 36 months. Say we didn't want all the money, we just want mm-hmm. X dollars out.
Sure.
Doesn't mean that they're going to take 36 months. I'm going to assume
exactly.
that other investors, when we suck money out, other investors are going to say, well, I want some of that.
Absolutely. But to your
maybe.
Point.
Well, yeah, maybe. But I mean, it's not, the 36 is not a hard and fast rule necessarily.
It's a parameter that they're asking for. And this, I'm using IFM as an example. JP Morgan, the same thing. However, to your point is we can elect not to reinvest our dividends. So dividends would be a very, it would be a form of liquidity in which we could really count on and kind of plan our liability and funding around that interest, which is certainly a reason we're looking at this asset class. So we can start to really define our liabilities on monthly, 12-month, 24-month, and this aspect is very attractive for what we're doing here.
How stable and consistent are the dividends?
So they advertise very stable. Because a lot of these investments are either leased and used by government entities or effectively, the term that they use is elasticity. They have a very low elasticity, meaning the demand for these tolls or airports or train stations doesn't necessarily fluctuate with an economy. And because that's the case, they can pretty much count the dividend or the distribution to be a bit pretty stable. So I think that's that dialogue's really helpful. It's kind of outlining the unique characteristics of the two kind of standard core, broad, globally exposed infrastructure plans. Harvest, so that's an MLP, a master limited partner. This is a bit different.
Yes. Just one quick,
yeah.
Using the bridge example, because, okay, we're getting the tolls, they know the tolls are coming through. The bridge gets blown up.
Yes.
Are they insured against that? Are they hedged against that?
So, generally speaking, absolutely yes. Okay. And that's something that, I mean, that's going to be an absolute due diligence question, as all these managers are going to have to check those boxes. Just like, I imagine, just like when we own a home, there's kind of more standard levels of insurance versus others, but definitely. But even that payout, while we're happy they're insured, we don't want that to happen because it does disrupt the dividend. But insurance will definitely be, and that's also a part of any hard asset purchasing. They need to have that level of insurance. Just like we might have a gain on a stock, we want to buy insurance, and PIMCO will buy, or excuse me, not stocks, but they'll have a security and fixed income, and they'll buy a futures exposure to hedge that. We want that. That's a good question.
Nate, is there a lot of beta exposure with the Harvest Fund?
It's an important distinction. I guess the question becomes beta to what? And generally speaking, that goes...
Do you have market beta?
Like to the equity markets.
Yeah.
So we ran a study, you can see in the memo, let's say page 2 in the memo, correlation matrix. Now this isn't beta. Beta is a slightly different formula. Unless Joan asks me, I won't tell you the formula, but if she does, I'll put it. There's a relationship to the two. And you can see Harvest, top line, you follow your eyes all the way over to where it meets the S&P column, it has a beta of 0.59. So there certainly is a relationship between the movement of the equity markets, and definitely more so than infrastructure, the two infrastructure funds. But anytime correlation is below 0.95%, we're taught to say that there are correlation and diversification benefits. So we definitely wanted to include the MLP as an overt option because there are diversification benefits. However, if you go also over to page 3, the top chart there, this shows the standard deviation of returns. And if you see the standard deviation of something like a Harvest MLP, it is similar to that of equity exposure. So while it does move with some idiosyncratic gyrations, you will see a standard deviation kind of similar to the equity markets.
It does have handsome...
3 years and 5 years. Is that the last 3 years, the last 5 years?
Yeah, trailing through March 31st, 2014.
It does have handsome correlations with bond returns and also the other two funds that you're proposing here as well.
Yep, and it's, you know, the diversification is absolutely why infrastructure is part of this asset allocation.
On page 3, any reason why the IFM and JPM have roughly the same returns, but it looks like the Harvest Fund is way out there cumulatively?
Right. So the MLP exposure is purchasing MLP equities. So they're in the equity markets. So you're going to have a very similar equity-like risk premium. It's going to have different risk characteristics and some, like we just highlighted, diversification benefits. But this is more risky. This is out on the risk, further out on the risk spectrum. It too has a yield, so it'll be given as a dividend. But especially over the last 5 years, MLPs have been sought after from the institutional community because of the yield, but also as a growth prospect. So this is an asset class and a portion of the infrastructure spectrum that has really run over the last 5 years.
So are we? We're taking money from equities to put into this.
Absolutely.
So we're taking. We should take equity-like risk if we're replacing an equity in the portfolio with diversification from the equities markets.
Absolutely.
So we shouldn't look at this as a bond that we're just trying to make 5 or 6%. It's not the dividend that we're playing for. It's a dividend plus a little equity kicker.
Absolutely. And both managers, all managers, quote, a target plus 10% return.
Right, but if we were looking at a more conservative allocation, then we'd be taking money off the bond portion of our portfolio and looking to replace that with an income play. And we have a target of 8%, 7.5%. You know. So you wouldn't take money out of equities and put it in something that you were going to fix a 6 to 7% return in.
Right.
We use infrastructure in our own model portfolio. It's something that we as a firm believe in as far as an investment thesis goes. It is a diversifier against the equity markets. It is, if you look at what they own, I mean, it's water, it's bridges, it's airports, it's energy. It's the transportation sector. I mean, it's how to get something from one place to the next is generally what they own.
Let me ask you, just because obviously you have exposure in your professional to...
Let's not consider that, though.
No, let's talk about it. Because when we talk about risks, you know, specifically related to MLPs, in light of kind of how they have run with the markets, that's an important question that we ask ourselves. Like, what are the major risks that could derail kind of the current MLP thesis? Why to have exposure there? I mean, do we look at it just as equity risk, or is there more of an underlying potential risk?
Well, I think you have to consider it an equity. It's just an equity with new exposure, right? It's exposure that we don't currently realize. And that's the movement of all the world's products, oil and gas and water and airplanes,
right,
and freight. And, you know, it's rail, it's bridges, it's everything we've talked about.
Right.
And we don't really have access to that in the portfolio that we currently own. So what I wanted to make sure is that we didn't think of this as a fixed income play,
sure,
where it's a 6-7% yield, and that's what we're getting. That's why we're investing. We're not investing in it for that reason. We're investing in it because we want exposure to a new asset class that gives us equity-like returns with a nice piece of diversification. So we just went from the REIT market, you know, publicly traded REIT market, to the non-traded REIT market because we wanted the underlying value of the asset to be valued, right?
Right.
I mean, we wanted the actual value of the building to be valued. And the reason we got out of publicly traded REITs is because it traded like equities, and we didn't really gain the exposure of real estate. That's not what we're looking for in this, I'm assuming. We're not looking for the same non-equity-like exposure to a diversified component of our portfolio. Right, we're looking for this to just add additional alpha and yield.
With a different DNA than equity.
Yeah, right.
So on the IMF, page 12, it's later on in there where you start looking at airport, roads, hydro, water, birth, that kind of stuff at the bottom here. It's kind of saying what you're getting into.
I think you're looking at a different page to page 12.
The bottom page 12. Of page 12.
Okay.
So the Melbourne page Airport, the Brisbane Airport.
Further in.
They like to own airports.
The page 12.
The other page 12.
Okay. Down under.
Down under.
So I'm just trying to get a sense of what we're talking about here.
Yes, sir.
And I figured as long as you got something that shows it, it's a little easier to see.
They like Australia.
Mm. Yeah, this particular manager is, has a good basis. Something, I guess, on that kind of vein, Gordon, both JP Morgan and IFM have significant exposure to the UK. Their exposure to the US is in about the mid 20% of the portfolio. Airports for IFM are one of their leading sectors, and then are pretty diversified after that. And I think you can see that on page 9 of the presentation, I think we're holding, the IFM presentation.
So would that be a difference between the two, is country type of thing they're in?
Interestingly enough, they're pretty similar in their country allocation. They both have UK as the dominant exposure in the portfolio, and the US a close second, which kind of goes back to that, the asset class simply maturing first abroad in the European market as an institutionally viable asset class. And now the US is certainly the one that's developing fast, and where the new assets are really being looked at is kind of in the U.S., especially with the shale boom and the natural gas that's now being cultivated and potentially distributed abroad at some point.
But this then is more like buying some water company and airport and the transportation type of stuff in the stock market, kind of, or this is different? Notice if I took the same dollars,
yep,
and instead I bought an American water company, an American airport,
right,
an American. You getting the same thing or not?
No. Well, technically, right, you would, if you're buying a stock, you're getting right to that company of its net profits.
Right.
This is, they're purchasing effectively private assets that they control, they manage, and they make the decisions over unilaterally. So you don't have that equity volatility that might be present if you're just purchasing, let's say, company, a water ETF for a water exposure? That's a good question. That's a fair point. IFM is a little bit bigger than JP Morgan as far as just total assets. Track records, a little bit longer. JP Morgan's kind of came into their own there in 2007.
Rick, what are we considering for this?
About $50 million across
the space. It's 2.5 at the moment.
So that's like 3% of our total allocation.
3% as of April 30th, I think it was.
And it could be one chunk or two pieces?
It could be
or?
17 across all three. You can split it, you know, 25-5 or 26 across two or give it all to one,
gotcha.
I would imagine.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we get to the point where we want to invite finalists, that's an important part of this. We can go ahead and do optimizations. That's all well and good. But it's important that we kind of understand their strategies to the point that we're, A, ready to commit funds, and then, B, what's the most efficient way. And I think that's right where we'll come alongside and kind of give maybe specific direction, but it's really predicated off of how many managers we want to really commit to.
So your question to us was if we're ready to talk to people,
yep.
We want more understanding.
Yep, correct.
And what kind of understanding would you bring us if we ask for more?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways we can go. We're not going to ask one of these managers to come to talk to us because they're at the moment part of a short list, and we don't want to give any of them an unfair advantage as far as just getting to meet you all and woo you. We could do a couple things where we might bring in, let's say, another manager that we're not going to invest with but that we have, you know, relationships with, and or bring in John Nicolini of our staff. He kind of heads up our real assets team, those strategies. He could come in and we would do maybe a bit more in-depth talk through different infrastructure plays.
I'd like that. I don't know how other people feel.
It's part of our education.
If we go back to the question that Rick asked about Harvest on page 3 of your cover, is the curve steeper for Harvest because there's so much into energy?
I missed that first part of the question.
Well, Rick asked how come the curve is so much higher for Harvest than the other two entities? And is it because Harvest is more heavily invested in energy? And that sector's been on a pretty steep curve.
Right. Maybe to some extent, I think the largest aspect is that they purchase equities. They're purchasing stocks, just like you and I might do. And those stocks are MLPs specifically, but still there is equity risk, standard public equity risk in their portfolio, and we can see that in the standard deviation. It's so much higher, and they're just like you get rewarded more for the greater risk that you take. So that's a culmination of this chart being bounded over the last 5 years, which, as we all know, has been a boom for equities.
Okay. So in my comparison to buying stock, Harvest would be closer than
this? Yes, absolutely.
So you could say that Harvest is a broker who concentrates on infrastructure, and they go out and buy stock in infrastructure, and the other two buy the infrastructure.
Yes. Yes. And obviously, right, you're going to get a lot more liquidity. We had the liquidity question. MLPs, it's daily liquidity. And maybe they'll say 3 days post-close, but I don't think that's really why we're getting into this space.
Well, and we have other places that we can be liquid.
Right.
So the first question is, do we want more education,
yep.
or are we ready to go to talking to people?
That's exactly it. Right.
How do people feel?
I think that if we're going to be in a position where we need to make a decision at some point, say, yes, we're going to commit, I think we need to be well-informed.
Sure.
So that we're not going getting to the brink and then going backwards.
Right.
So I'd rather get the education up front.
And I'll tell you guys, this is an asset class where there is no rush. Airports don't flip on a dime. And let's enjoy not having a rush to make a commitment. And like I said, I think John Nicolini's great. He's done a couple other presentations to some other counties. And I love dragging him out and making him do what he does best. So.
Good.
Showing him how the other half lives.
Okay. Oh, no, he's the other. We are the other half.
Then I recommend that we get...
Drag out.
Get your person dragged out.
Oh, yeah. I say that very affectionately.
Any other comments?
So
So the motion is for further education.
Yes.
Well, let me just kind of also put it back. Does this make sense, kind of what we're talking about as far as
starting to?
right. But that's huge, right? That's why we're doing this. Like, does it make sense that we're bringing to you the open-ended concept? Does it make sense we're bringing you the core concept? Is this resonating as far as the risk, part of the risk spectrum that we're kind of highlighting? I think that's important. Just I can get that feedback, you know, informally. I put that back out to you guys.
Say that again.
Does kind of the area of infrastructure that we're bringing to you, the core aspect, the open-ended aspect, the global aspect, does that seem to make sense versus maybe something more concentrated, maybe something more risky? I want to make sure that, you know, we're providing you guys with something that resonates.
As opposed to us going out and buying an airport?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And Dollar Rush.
Thank you. Okay. Great.
I noticed, you know, a lot of variation in the fees that they're charging, different ways they're calculating it. It's, especially with Harvest, the way I see, well, I guess they've got different targets, but you see there's a lot of difference in the way that they're charging their fees
right. Between
the different companies.
Right, so.
I would really need to see what that was, it's a little more clearly between them.
Your man could tell us about that?
I can even tell you about that.
Bold?
So there's a column that I actually deleted, and I wish I would have kept it. It's a TRE column. It's total expense ratio. So, for instance, to your point, IFM charges a management fee and a performance fee. JP Morgan also. Harvest, they're just giving you a basis point fee, just the same as any other equity manager might, 70 basis points for the level of the commitment we're looking at. IFM is giving us a management fee plus 20% of profits above an 8% hurdle, no catch-up. That is an equivalent over, let's say, since 1994 to 1.37% total of all-in management fee, including the performance. JP Morgan is very, very similar. The difference is they only charge a 15% performance fee, but that's over a hurdle of 7% versus 8%. So once they get to a return of 7%, now they're really going to start participating on that performance fee. IFM is higher. It's a bigger slug, 20% versus 15. That hurdle is 8%. I like the larger hurdle. I want us to get money back, and then they can start feeling really good about what they're doing. IFM also keeps 60% of their carry or their performance fee basically banked in case there's any clawback or future underperformance that requires them to give back.
So only 40%. Exactly. They do give back in a bad performance?
Exactly. So their high watermark, they're held to that high watermark. So they're going to collect the performance fee at a certain point, but it's not distributed until long down the road. Always. It's a perpetual 60% that's kind of kept in their coffers in case something happens.
But they hold it.
Yeah, absolutely. They do hold it. And they kind of invest it, and they, you know, but it's there.
So I think we need to a second on the motion to bring in...
Yeah. We'll bring in the special.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion. All in favor, signify by saying
aye.
Wait
a second. I want
to... Oh. I'm trying to get through.
Repeat the motion. The motion was to...
To bring in somebody.
To provide more education.
Yeah, coming for further education.
I just didn't hear it. So.
Yes. The motion is for further education. Do you want to say anything? Or?
No, I just didn't hear the
That's
motion.
Fine. Okay. All
I
in favor.
Wanted to be sure what I was voting on.
Oh, that's fine. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay.
Who says no to education?
That's what I said. You know, apparently that wasn't a recall. We move on to, what is it? C.
Okay, I'm going to go. So I already ruined my kind of big intro. The Wall Street Journal article, big investors missed rally. And I have dot, 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 not Stan Sarah. And that's 90% of the returns we generate are based on asset allocation. And there's been significant education and continuity reinforcement around this table, even with trustee transition. And there's not going to be a committee to really kind of pat everyone on the back, so it's important every once in a while that we acknowledge kind of the important collective restraint and commitment to a plan that we've held to. And this report, just like the last few months and quarters we've gone through, is a reflection of that. So we're 5 years into a full recovery. You see that reflected throughout this page, the monthly market update. We look at over the last month, large cap outperformed small cap, and value outperformed growth. Growth outperformed value almost across the board. If you look all the way over in that very top chart to that 10-year column, you can see the returns of a trailing 10-year to May 2014. If I go down all of these columns, all of these returns are higher than SIS's most recent market capital expectations. I think it's just it's a fair kind of warning to say that we've experienced a strong recovery to date, and to maybe mute or have expectations be a bit more conservative going forward. From the international standpoint, we look at the MSCI ACWI ex-US, another strong month. We also see the emerging market had a very strong month. The EM space has really struggled to date. They've really been affected to develop world monetary policy, and we're starting to see that kind of stabilize. And again, China, we saw growth expectations really picked up. PMI was outperformed by eight points in China, which has a ripple effect throughout that particular index. Something that's also kind of unique of the 1 month, the bond market performed quite well. So we had both equities and bonds perform well over this the most recent period. You can see the Barclays Ag returning 1.14% over the month, and also the EM space returning 3.2% month to date, and year to date 8.45%. Getting into page one, looking at Stansara's portfolio. At the end of May, assets stand at $1,750,226,000. If we look at our asset allocations, same page, we can kind of highlight on it. We're exactly within range with the exception of domestic equities. We're above that. That's been intentional. That's been overweight we've kept on for quite some time. That's been overweight that's paid. We are at the point of cycling out of that, and infrastructure is going to be the next recipient of those of that overweight. Page two, we look at the cash that's been generated month to date, $22.7 million. Year to date, the prior year, $210 million as a result of the fund's asset allocation investments. I'll just gloss over page three and page four. Check marks across the board. Cash levels remain low, which is what we want. So page five. I'm starting with domestic equity. Managers performing basically in line flat with the exception of Legato. They've been trailing over the last, not just this month, the last few months. Always like to start with what's worse, and then we'll get to what's better. So with Legato, getting a chance to talk with their team the last couple days, it's a function of a few things. They've picked bad stocks. Other than that also, it's been value has really outperformed growth. They have some microcap exposure, and microcap has not been rewarded over this most recent few months. And if you remember last few months, biotech went crazy. You had some unbelievable returns from these very binary outcomes. Biotech companies are entering the market. They don't need to get venture capital anymore because the stock market's readily giving them funding, and these companies are set up with either a home run or a strikeout. And quite a few got some home runs over the last few months, and as of lately, there's been a few strikeouts. So that volatility really affects the index that captures everything, where Legato has not had exposure to those dynamic biotech stocks. Dodd & Cox has been doing really well. We'll see that in the top 10, sticking to their horses. And Cap Prospects, we get to see Marilyn and Liz continue to do a very solid job. And in fixed income space, pretty flat for Dodd & Cox, PIMCO. 20 basis points of outperformance. Something of note, we got to see Bill Gross be in the headlines the last few days in the journal and really kind of commit to PIMCO's current stance that short-term rates are going to stay low longer than what the Fed's indicating. So that's an overarching kind of thesis or philosophy that's being played out, kind of all PIMCO products, that rates are going to stay low longer. We'll see if that happens. I guess it's also fair to note Bill Gross has been active in insider trading, purchasing PIMCO's dynamic credit fund, ticker symbol PDI. There's no takeaway. I just thought it was interesting, so I share it with you.
Did you see, couldn't figure out why there was 13 straight months of outflow
well,
PIMCO?
Yeah, he also said he's been on the road trying to convince people how nice of a guy he is more than ever in his life.
Right.
You know, it's
the things we worry about.
Yeah, I mean, when you're that successful and you gain that much that many assets, there's going to be a microscope, and it burns at the moment when the sun shines through. Part of it. But that's also something we'll continue to monitor just because it's such a headline. And to some extent, that's our benefit because it's such a headline. We can really kind of track the comings and goings a bit more. The direct lenders, this is kind of a need to see. If you look, we're about halfway to them fully ramping up their exposures, their allocations across the board, if I look at them as one entity. Yeah, fiscal year to date, return is 7.1% versus the custom 8.36%. That's really good because that calculation does not account for the most recent distributions that we'll get back here in the next month or two. So that 7.1% is really a reflection of the portfolio's asset appreciation. And we're going to start getting in our calculations. White Oak just came in. You see it's a 0% for May. We got that in after the paper had been delivered. So we got a bump there, which will be reflected next month. Our international equity managers struggled a bit for the current month, specifically Pyramus. I also reached out to Pyramus to kind of get a sense for what's happened with them over the course of the year. It's a function of the market going in the opposite direction, as they say. There has been a strong rotation in the European stocks to lower quality equities, and Pyramus has always been a very traditionally a high quality manager, which does well in corrections, but will lag in kind of this consistent low volatility market environment that we're in. We also have some EM exposure, which, although has helped recently, has struggled for the longer year-to-date period. While we gave some back on a relative basis, we still returned a 1.46% month-to-date, and fiscal year-to-date, we're at 1602 versus a policy index of 14.76, or 126 basis points of excess return.
Any guesses for fiscal year 13, 14?
So we need to not have days like today.
Hmm. What happened?
Well, we've only got four more days.
Why did you say that?
I can lose a lot in 4 days.
I put that on record. No, you're right. And, you know, there's been such low volatility in the markets. I don't have a chart with me today. But across the board, regardless of the asset class, we are below historical means. And as a function of that, any blip in volatility or any exogenous event that's got the markets are going to feel, they're really going to feel it. It's a function of A, monetary policy wanting that. There was a study, a survey in The Economist this last week that really tried to put a lasso around the minds of central bankers. And they said there's a study out that they've produced internally, IMF, specifically the Fed. If you look over the next 10 years, and you put a scenario in place, the first scenario is we keep interest rates low, and you're guaranteed to have another recession 60% as severe as the one that we experienced in 2008. Or you avoid that by having interest rates a bit higher, 1.5%. The amount of jobs that would be created and then the amount of asset appreciation that would occur under that first scenario, even with the recession, trumps the alternate scenario where you'd go ahead and raise rates. So you collectively have a group of monetary policy, people creating monetary policy that understand that there are risking asset bubbles, but there's a conviction that that risk and even the actualization of a recession somewhere in the next 10 years outweighs avoiding a recession. I hope I paraphrase that to some extent. To me, that was really interesting and revealing and maybe sadistically makes sense.
Well, if there is a chance for asset bubbles in the future, will they be evident or will they be lurking out there and nobody will be expecting it?
Yeah. I think it's going to be both. I think there is such hindsight bias even today. Every meeting we get together, with just quickness, we can reference 2008. And not only do people know what we're talking about, they feel what we're talking about. It seems like enough time needs to pass where that's hard to remember what it felt like. And I'm kind of speaking from a behavioral finance standpoint. Mm-hmm. The market needs to not remember what it feels, what 2008 feels like. And that's going to take a long, long time. There'll be corrections. To some extent, we welcome them and want them. But
for there still to be so much reference to 2008 and 2009.
Remember,
that's going to affect the markets.
There's still people around that remember the Depression, so
true.
You know, there's
absolutely
always going to be some, but
absolutely. And Warren Buffett's uncle never could get past what took place in the Depression in the 20s, and he did well for himself, but he wasn't a Buffett. He wasn't like Buffett Senior. So that mentality will always exist, and it makes a market. We need it to make a market, but I think from an institutional standpoint, the wounds are still fresh.
Housing's going up, though.
Yeah, you're right.
And week by week.
Mm-hmm. It's a real positive, especially for the household balance sheet. It's mm-hmm. an absolute positive. And there'll be a psychological benefit that'll trickle into the market because of that. And we welcome that, especially here in the Valley. Open arms. I'm from here. Absolutely get it.
For sure.
There's something I noticed the other day going, I drive down McHenry Avenue, the car lots are full.
Mm-hmm.
The inventory during 08, 09, 10, and even 11, they had all the cars widely spaced apart, so you could not really, trying to pretend they had cars. The car lots are absolutely packed with inventory again. So that's something we haven't seen for a while, which means credit money must be.
And that's actually, yeah, it's very telling because, of course, along Crow's Landing, you had tons of car lots. Mm-hmm. As soon as, you know, by 09, 80% of them had gone away. Mm-hmm. So, and now they're back.
It's an interesting thing to say.
Definitely.
On the
downside,
at the people
the property taxes are going up.
Good.
Oh, boy.
10%.
He's happy about it.
10%.
Think
put that magic calculator away.
That's just what's
is that this month or
today? At least for the whole county, the revenues are supposed to be up 10%.
Yeah. Don't spend it yet.
Too late.
Oh yeah, we're doing it in the labor negotiations.
You may have to spend it.
You all can have raises, but your property taxes just went up.
Well, I mean, it's all set by state law.
It's
a formula.
It's all equity.
If your value of your house goes up, 20%, you have to think that your property tax is going to go up, too.
Isn't that great?
Oh. Kind of like the cycle of life.
You tell them not to think about the 2% limitation. It doesn't apply. It goes up to 20%.
That's the downside of having your value of your house increase.
Guys, we just had a great discussion about how well
stuff
works. I'm happy.
Nate, what other great news can we transition
to? Well, why don't we do the top 10 real quick? I think if I was trying to write a theme over the top 10, it's the low volatility in the market. We kind of see that across the managers. Pretty flat. Most managers have somewhere between 5 positive, 5 negative. First page is just our index. Oh, yeah, Apple.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's a big
I have this all like a formula, so I just plug and chug.
Yep.
And as it happened with Google, we didn't catch the Apple split. Split 7 to 1, actually increased by 0.92% that holding.
Yep.
So. Yes.
Yeah, I noticed that when I saw the 85%. I said, they split 7 to 1.
It's a bad investment, huh?
Apple stock has really went up a lot in the last few months.
Yeah.
6 months. It was a low of about 400, and now
it's overvalued.
The old way, probably 600.
Yeah, it was interesting. The LSV, if you remember, like, I don't know, the 633.
According to Nate's report.
According to my
report. Oh, yeah, I see. 6:30. No, Legato, you were talking about bad selection.
Yep.
Down 9%.
Yep.
And down 7% and 6%.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So United Foods, they're kind of caught in kind of their sector. That's more of a sector play. There's a lot of legal bouts going on about food distributors, and they're kind of getting caught up in the ebb and flow of that. Maximus, they
forget what they do. Ticker symbol MMS. It'll remember me when I'll remember it when I start talking about Interlap. Interlap's network service provider, cloud computing. They have a beta of 1.4, so they are going to fly around one way or the other. And I don't remember what Maximus is, so I'm not going to even pretend. But they too, they've been in the top 10 for a while now, along with Portfolio Recovery, and they are high octane holdings that definitely have an impact on the total performance of the fund. So with the Maximus down 7%, we feel that specifically.
Okay, any questions for anybody, or ready to move on to item 8, Executive Director?
This is the report out on the 2014 due diligence trip. So a few weeks ago, the due diligence team got together and went to San Francisco to talk to three of our investment managers, BlackRock, Jackson Square, which was used to be Delaware, and Dodge & Cox. And the last day, we also met with SIS, the group from SIS. Maria, myself, Jeff Grover, Nate, and Paul attended. And just to give you a brief update on our findings, we spent a couple hours with BlackRock, and you can jump in here if you want to, and they're the ones that manage our passive funds, about $230 million approximately for us. Not a lot of excitement in that type of discussion. Discussion centered mostly around passive versus active investing. And one thing that was interesting is that they've added about, I think it was 6.3 basis points of excess return on a passive fund over the last 3 years, which is interesting. And we asked them that question, and they earn that excess return essentially by securities lending. They get the extra income from the securities lending in their portfolio. Again, not much there. There was nothing to sway us to not invest with BlackRock. We then went and met with Jackson Square Partners, which was much more interesting. They were formerly Delaware. Recently, they broke off from Delaware and formed their own group, Jackson Square Partners. They wanted more autonomy and control of the investment decision and also compensation, the way they're compensated. The Jackson Square Group now owns 50.1% of that investment, and Delaware continues to own 49.1% of it. From what we could tell, the move seemed amicable between the two. There was one issue, though, that Delaware has given Jackson Square, I believe, 2 years to get their own infrastructure system in place. Right now, Delaware is giving them infrastructure and other types of services to help get them off the ground. So Jackson Square does have 2 years to get that in place on their own. And in that respect, the due diligence team recommended just continuing to watch that situation over the next few years and make sure that that transition to Jackson Square's own systems and infrastructure is smooth. The next day we met with Dodge & Cox. That was another uneventful discussion. They don't see much change in interest rates over the next several years, so they don't see much change in their portfolio, and I don't think we should expect much change in their portfolio. And then finally we met with SIS. We met with the founder, Barry Dennis, I believe was his name. Yes, Barry Dennis. He's got an interesting wife, Jackie Spears. Congresswoman. Anyway, there was a fairly reasonably big change at SIS. They had an executive at the top leave for what he termed as greener pastures. and also Barry intimated that they were going to change their org structure to a more team-oriented approach, if I'm correct there. And also, we asked Barry, and he agreed to come out and speak with the board on this change at SIS over the next couple months. I think you might want to add something
sure.
to that.
What's neat about SIS, and actually for me personally, why I went there, now it's been over 4 years ago, is because it's small. It's small by design. We're 30 strong. And we got about the same amount of clients, more or less. And in the business plan, as it stands today, is that's not going to change as far as our clients goes. We will continue to be a boutique. And consequently, for instance, a case for like Pete, he got an offer that's effectively as green as the pastures come.
Could not refuse.
I'm sorry?
That he could not refuse.
I guess he could have, but he didn't. His wife, who also works at SIS, is from New York. His position is in New York with from Cliffwater. She actually is staying on with SIS. So if you could speak to any of the, how amicable this is, she's going to stay. She's going to work from New York, and she is a really wonderful lady. And it, for us, it's really sad because we love Pete, but this happens, and it's kind of a function of SIS's most endearing qualities. And every once in a while, it's you know, this happens. But unaffected to our team and our kind of our life here, it's transient in nature. The team concept also, I guess, almost functionally for Stan Sarah, will be also somewhat transient in the sense that Paul and I are already kind of functioning as a team. That's pretty indicative of it's been successful. And so I think there's almost this is almost a blueprint that they're going to stamp in a couple other spaces at the company. So
I think Barry was kind of suggesting they were going to add more teams in terms of areas of expertise, real estate,
yep.
Infrastructure, and stuff like that.
Yep. Hedge funds, real estate, which is an asset class that can be interpreted a number of different ways, but it's definitely something that we believe in. But for our clients, we're very conservative. We want to make sure that those asset classes are right for our clients. And, we've been slow to go that way, but in the pipe, it's coming down.
So Mr. Dennis will come and speak about this transition. And also I failed to mention that I think it's July next month, Jackson Square will have, I think Keith will come here, and he's going to speak directly to the board about the transition or the break off between Delaware and Jackson Square. But other than that, I don't know if Marie has anything to add. We didn't see any reason to be alarmed about any aspect of our trip other than that small blip with Jackson Square.
Yeah. But BlackRock was pretty impressive. They seem to have their act together pretty well. Jackson Square, still in evolving. Dodge and Cox, Bob, it was intimated that, well, no, he pretty much said that he's pretty much retiring next year.
That's right.
So that's one of the changes that we can expect to see. Other than that, it's nothing earth-shattering or even windy. So
no, it was windy when we were walking through there, if I remember right.
It was a beautiful day in San Francisco.
Okay.
So it bode well.
They all are.
Yeah. Except when it rains hard. But no, they were all of our money managers seemed to have their act together.
That's all.
Okay, need a motion to go in closed session.
We don't have closed session.
We don't have closed session?
No. Then, didn't you say we would probably be dead about 3:30? I think we're right on the ball.
Yeah.
Members?
Those
at least
holders.
I don't have anything on closed session.
No,
do you,
I
Rick?
Don't.
Okay. That was quick.
Do you want to go into closed session?
I kind of miss it. members forum.
I have nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing except I apologize for showing up late.
Nothing.
They don't have anything either.
I apologize for being late as well, but I must have something to do with being retired.
We're glad you came. We lost one, we gained one, you know.
Not paying attention to the time is more likely.
Donna?
Nothing for me.
Nothing.
I just wanted to mention that I'm starting to tell people not to retire because they just don't have the time.
Busier now.
I have to work on that.
I had somebody else tell me that. Feels busier now than the size of the
one.
I hope I win.
Wonderful.
Why did
thanks,
we
Lee.
Have
appreciate
this
it.
In our packet? Not the attachments that are referred to.
You can have the attachments, but there's probably 5 or 6 pages to that. All I was trying to convey was that Scott got comfortable with the negotiations with Greenfield and their attorney. And that was the direction that the board gave us 2 weeks ago.
Try to get home.
Yep.
So we're a go on that investment and it'll be placed soon.
We've already got a capital call.
Meeting adjourned.
Have it done.
Thank you.